The lights grew brighter as dusk came to an end, their eyes refocused in the semi-lit darkness of Rakefield. Another, smaller group of old Spartans had materialized at the far end of the bleachers. Their voices were barely audible. Silo opened another bottle and drained half of it. "When was the last time you saw Rake?" Blanchard Teague asked Neely. "A couple of days after my first surgery," Neely said, and everyone was still. He was telling a story that had never been told before in Messina. "I was in the hospital," he said. "One surgery down, three to go." "It was a cheap shot," Couch mumbled, as if Neely needed to be reassured. "Damn sure was," said Amos Kelso. Neely could see them, huddling in the coffee shops on Main Street, long, sad faces, low, gray voices, as they replayed the late hit that instantly ruined the career of their All-American. A nurse told him she had never seen such an outpouring of compassion. Cards, flowers, chocolates, balloons, artwork from entire classes of grade schoolers, all from the small town of Messina, 3 hours away. Other than his parents and the tech coaches, Neely refused all visitors. For 8 long days, he drowned himself in pity, aided mightily by as many painkillers as the doctors would allow. Rake slipped in one night, long after visiting hours were over. "He tried to cheer me up," Neely said, sipping a beer. "Said knees could be rehabbed. I tried to believe him." "Did he mention the 87 championship game?" Silo asked. "We talked about it." There was a long, awkward pause as they contemplated that game and all the mysteries around it. It was Messina's last title, and that alone was a source rich enough for years of analysis. Down 31-0 at halftime, roughed up and manhandled by a vastly superior team from East Pike, the Spartans returned to the field at A&M, where 35,000 fans were waiting. Rake was absent. He didn't appear until late in the fourth quarter. The truth about what happened had remained buried for 15 years, and evidently, neither Silo, Neely, nor Paul, nor Hubcap Taylor were about to break the silence. In the hospital room, Rake had finally apologized, but Neely had told no one. Teague and Couch said goodbye and jogged away in the darkness. "You never came back, did you?" Yeager asked. "Not after I got hurt," Neely said. "Why not?" "I didn't want to." Hubcap had been working quietly on a pint of something much stronger than beer. He'd said little, and when he spoke, his tongue was thick. "People say you hated Rake." "That's not true. And he hated you." "Rake had a problem with the stars," Paul said. "We all knew that. If you won too many awards, set too many records, Rake got jealous, plain and simple. He worked us like dogs, and he wanted every one of us to be great. But when guys like Neely got all the attention, then Rake got envious." "I don't believe that," Orly Short grunted. "It's true. Plus, he wanted to deliver the prizes to whatever college he happened to like at the moment. He wanted Neely at State." "He wanted me in the Army," Silo said. "Lucky you didn't go to prison," Paul said. "It ain't over yet," Silo said with a laugh. Another car rolled to a stop by the gate, and its headlights went off. No door opened. "Prison's underrated," Hubcap said, and everyone laughed. "Rake had his favorites," Neely said. "I wasn't one of them." "Then why are you here?" asked Orly Short. "I'm not sure. Same reason you're here, I guess." During Neely's freshman year at Tech, he had returned from Messina's homecoming game. In a halftime ceremony, they retired number 19. The standing ovation went on and eventually delayed the second half kickoff, which cost the Spartans 5 yards and prompted Coach Rake, leading 28-0, to start yelling. That was the only game Neely had watched since he left. 1 year later, he was in the hospital. "When did they put up Rake's bronze statue?" he asked. "A couple of years after they fired him," Yeager said. "The boosters raised $10,000 and had it done. They wanted to present it to him before a game, but he refused. So he never came back." "Well, sort of." Yeager pointed to a hill in the distance behind the clubhouse. He'd drive up on Carr's Hill before every game and park on one of those gravel roads. He and Miss Lila would sit there, looking down, listening to Buck Coffey on the radio, too far away to see much, but making sure the town knew he was still watching. At the end of every halftime, the band would face the hill and play the fight song, and all 10,000 would wave at Rake. "It was pretty cool," said Amos Kelso. "Rake knew everything that was going on," Paul said. Rabbit called him twice a day with the gossip. "Was he a recluse?" Neely asked. "He kept to himself," Amos said, "for the first 3 or 4 years anyway. There were rumors that he was moving, but then rumors don't mean much here. He went to Mass every morning, but that's a small crowd in Messina." "He got out more in the last few years," Paul said, "started playing golf." "Was he bitter?" The question was pondered by the rest of them. "Yeah, he was bitter," Yeager said. "I don't think so," Paul said. "He blamed himself." "Rumor has it that they'll bury him next to Scotty," Amos said. "I heard that too," Silo said, very deep in thought. A car door slammed and a figure stepped onto the track. A stocky man in a uniform of some variety swaggered around the field and approached the bleachers. "Here's trouble," Amos mumbled. "It's Mal Brown," Silo said softly. "Our illustrious sheriff," Paul said to Neely. "Number 31? That's him." Neely's number 19 was the last jersey to be retired. Number 31 was the first. Mal Brown had played in the mid-60s during the streak. 80 pounds and 35 years ago, he had been a bruising tailback who once carried the ball 54 times in a game, still a Messina record.